Welcome to the Weekly Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It is Monday, July 13th, 2026, and this is our Startups Edition.
Today, we are examining the fundamental decoupling of software utility from user interface, a shift that moves us from interactive dashboards to autonomous, headless systems. We are witnessing a transition from a period defined by human-in-the-loop oversight to an era of backgrounded, agentic execution.
Essentially, the interface is disappearing as the intelligence takes over.
So here's the picture. That disappearance is the primary driver of the first major trend we are tracking today.
Salesforce's headless 360 is officially live, and Slack is reporting a 300% surge in bot usage. We are officially moving past the era of clicking buttons and into the era of talking to our software.
It's the beginning of the agentic shift, Maya. We're moving from UI-centric software, where a human has to navigate a complex menu of buttons, to headless systems where the primary user isn't a person, but an AI agent interacting directly with an API.
Which sounds incredibly efficient for a spreadsheet, but sounds like a nightmare for anyone who actually likes being in control of their workflow. Are we just delegating our entire professional lives to a headless ghost in the machine?
It's less about ghosts and more about the decoupling of logic from interface. As Seema Amble argues, the value of software is migrating away from the visual UI and settling into the underlying data and the embedded business logic. If an agent can pull a report via an API without ever rendering a dashboard, the dashboard becomes an optional luxury, not a functional necessity.
So if you're a startup founder building a new CRM, you don't need to worry about whether your submit button is a pretty shade of blue. You just need to make sure your data is agent-readable.
We can trace that further. That's a massive trap for the vibe coding crowd. There's this huge movement right now. This term vibe coding has only been in the lexicon for about 10 weeks, where people are using LLMs to rapidly generate entire enterprise tools just by describing the vibe of what they want. It's incredibly powerful for prototyping, but it hits a wall when it meets reality.
Because vibes don't satisfy the IRS or the GDPR.
The data tells a story. The A16Z show notes that replacing legacy systems like SAP with a modern stack of APIs is a fundamental misconception. The real difficulty isn't the code. It's the unreplicable, customized business logic and the regulatory compliance that has been baked into those old systems over decades. You can vibe a front-end into existence in an afternoon, but you can't vibe a multi-jurisdictional tax compliance engine into existence.
It's the difference between painting a picture of a bridge and actually engineering one to support 1,000 tons of freight.
That's a great way to put it. And for startups, this creates a very specific three-tier complexity matrix. First, you have lookup functions. These are lightweight, easy to automate, and low risk. Then you have action or transactional functions, which introduce massive new risks around identity and seat licensing. If an agent performs 1 million transactions, who is logged in? Finally, there are analysis functions. These are the hardest because they require massive scalability for hallucination verification. You can't just let an agent summarize a contract without a heavy-duty loop to verify it against the source text.
So the agentic dream of automating everything actually creates a new, much more expensive layer of verification work. We're just trading clicking buttons for auditing bots.
But look at the upside for the one-person founder. Mark Pincus and Reid Hoffman have both pointed out that this shift is democratizing product creation. When the technical execution, the actual writing of the syntax, is commoditized, the competitive advantage shifts from how well you can code to your individual taste.
I love that. It's like what Rick Rubin says about music. The value isn't in the technical ability to play a scale, it's the artist's unique point of view. Vibe coding is essentially the digital version of musical sampling. You're taking existing blocks of logic and recontextualizing them to create a new vision.
But even for the most talented taster, there's a massive gap between a product that works and a product that scales in a corporate environment. AI agents face a fundamental exception handling hurdle. The most critical business value in any enterprise exists in the long tail of edge cases, those weird, specific regional response policies or unique customer preferences that aren't in any structured database. If your agent can't handle the weird, it's useless for a global company.
It sounds like we're building these incredibly smart, headless engines that are brilliant at the 90% of standard tasks, but completely paralyze the moment a customer asks for something slightly non-standard.
And that's where the art of finishing comes in. A16Z argues that the fundamental challenge of enterprise decision-making is reaching consensus and stability, a human-centric process that doesn't have a programmable API yet. You can automate the data retrieval, but you can't yet automate the human agreement required to move a project into production.
So the headless future is actually just a very efficient way to feed a human decision-maker more data, rather than replacing them.
It's a tool, not a replacement. Even in the creative space, like with Luma or Photo Labs, the evolution is moving away from text-only prompting toward controllable agentic workflows. We aren't just shouting commands at a box anymore. We are directing agents through complex, iterative, multimodal workflows using sketches and visual examples. We are moving from being operators of tools to directors of intelligent agents.
It's a shift from manual labor to creative orchestration. But if we're moving toward a world where the UI is disappearing, how do brands even exist? If there's no interface to interact with, how do you build a brand experience?
You have to pivot your strategy. As Masters of Scale suggested, modern brand strategy has to move from owned media to a priming and proving framework. You use traditional marketing to prime the human audience, but you have to simultaneously prove your value to the LLMs. You need to secure authoritative mentions in third-party communities like Reddit or YouTube, because those are the training sets and the knowledge bases that the agents are querying. Your brand isn't what people see on your website anymore. It's the digital footprint that an agent encounters when it's looking for a solution.
So if you want to win the agentic era, you don't build a beautiful website, you build a compelling reputation in the datasets.
You're aiming for agentic loops where you capture a data exhaustive performance. For example, a startup shouldn't just track sales, they should track which specific communication styles or product features drive the highest response rates in different global markets, and then feed that back into the loop.
It's all becoming one giant self-optimizing feedback loop. Even cybersecurity is being rewritten. The cost-benefit analysis is shifting because the cost of addressing insecure code is plummeting due to AI, but the cost of leaving it unpatched is skyrocketing because AI is also being used for automated exploitation. It's an arms race of automation.
A dual-use paradox. If you restrict a model's ability to identify vulnerabilities to prevent hackers from using it, you also prevent the defenders from using that same capability to proactively patch their systems. The entire economic landscape of maintenance is being restructured.
It's a high-stakes game of whack-a-mole where the hammer is also an AI.
The implication runs deeper, the friction is moving. It's moving from the how of execution to the what of direction and the why of verification.
Software developers need to start thinking less like builders and more like architects and auditors.
And founders need to prioritize the unautomatable logic, the messy human regulatory stuff, rather than just chasing the latest vibe.
Enterprise procurement officers should start auditing the hallucination resilience of their vendors' APIs, not just their uptime.
And keep an eye on the action functions in the next wave of Slack integrations. If we see a surge in agents actually executing financial transactions without human oversight, the entire concept of seat licensing is going to implode.
But all of this automation and the shift toward directing agents brings us to the next big bottleneck. Where do you find the people who actually have the taste to lead these systems? I don't know, Alex. I'm looking at this whole investing in talent thesis, and it feels a lot like just paying a premium for people who are good at being charismatic. If we're moving toward a world where venture capital is less about auditing a product and more about betting on the spark in a founder, aren't we just recreating the most volatile, irrational bubble in history?
It's definitely a shift, but it's not just about charisma. It's about a fundamental change in how we identify scalable patterns. We're seeing the venture model evolve from pure technical due diligence into something more like technical power brokering, where the value add isn't just capital, but the ability to use narrative and marketing to scale a company's footprint.
So instead of checking if the code actually works, you're just checking if the founder can write a compelling press release. That sounds like a very expensive way to fund a bunch of overhyped influencers.
Not exactly. Take Guy Osery's approach, for instance. He's essentially applying the music industry's toolkit, the same rapid pattern matching he used to sign artists like Alanis Morissette to the tech sector. He views founders as rock stars, using the same mechanics of identifying the spark and building massive global narratives that help scale companies like Vitacoco. He's looking for that moment of magic, where you can visualize a massive hit even before the data proves it.
Magic. That is a terrifying word to hear in a room full of people managing billions of dollars. It sounds like a way to avoid doing the actual math.
But the math is in the pattern, not just the spreadsheet. Osri argues that the most effective way to spot these shifts is by watching unconventional information streams, things like noticing changes in talent migration via headhunters, or seeing which physical products are suddenly ubiquitous in specific professional hubs. It's about recognizing a market dominance, like the transition from smartphone ubiquity to the foundational importance of AI models, before the official market reports even catch up.
Okay, so you're a detective, not an analyst. But even if you find this spark, how do you actually measure if a person is a good bet? Is there a rubric for magic, or do we just check their horoscope?
It's less about horoscopes and more about identifying specific high-utility personality architectures. Graham Duncan, for example, talks about a management philosophy of placing people in positive feedback loops by matching their natural inclinations to specific roles. He suggests that the most effective leaders don't just hire for competence, but for the ability to design an organization where, say, a salesperson who actually enjoys the rejection of cold calling is placed in a position where that trait becomes a self-sustaining engine.
So we're just building highly optimized human hamster wheels.
We're building systems that minimize the need for active management. And it goes deeper than just fitting in. Duncan argues that the real value in talent lies in the tension between opposing traits, specifically the balance of aggression and integrity. He calls this being commercial, the capacity to take massive, decisive, aggressive positions while maintaining an ethical core that ensures the person creates more value than they capture. If you have the aggression without the integrity, you're just a liability.
I suppose that's slightly more rigorous than a vibe check. But what about the people who don't fit the standard mold? I assume if you're looking for taste over judgment, you're essentially looking for people who are predictably unpredictable.
Stepping back, the idea is that judgment implies there is one single correct answer, whereas taste allows a leader to recognize unique, non-obvious patterns of excellence in people who don't meet traditional, standardized criteria. It's about identifying a plus potential in idiosyncratic strengths. Even things like dyslexia are being reframed not as a deficit, but as a driver for adaptive problem solving and social intelligence, because the necessity to mask that disability often forces the development of superior listening skills and an ability to build resource-reliant social networks.
It sounds like we're just rebranding every personality quirk as a competitive advantage to justify a higher valuation.
It's more about resilience. There is a strong argument that successful entrepreneurship can be predicted by an individual's ability to navigate profound personal or professional blowups. The capacity to overcome a significant past crisis serves as the most reliable forecast for how they will handle the inevitable friction of a scaling startup.
I'll admit, seeing a founder who has survived a total collapse is more convincing than seeing a founder who has never faced a single consequence.
And that's where the institutional side comes in. While we talk about individual talent, the structural side is also shifting. The A16Z show recently highlighted how scientific progress is currently hitting a wall because of a mismatch in funding. While small-scale grants work for incremental research, the breakthroughs we need in biology, like building virtual cell models, require massive 10 to 15-year capital commitments of hundreds of millions of dollars. This is a gap that traditional venture capital hasn't quite figured out how to bridge, creating a space for strategic philanthropy to target that middle ground of innovation.
So we have founders with the spark, managers building feedback loops, and massive funding gaps in biotech. It's a lot of moving parts to keep from crashing into each other.
It is, but the goal of the modern venture firm is to act as the stabilizer, using strategic power brokering to de-risk international expansion for these startups, facilitating massive deals in emerging markets before the company even has a local legal entity.
Investors are essentially becoming international diplomats with much larger checkbooks.
They're becoming the infrastructure itself.
Founders should start looking for partners who can navigate a foreign legal system, not just someone who can read a cap table. But we should keep an eye on whether these massive, long-term bets in biology actually yield a patent, or if we're just funding a decade of very expensive vibes. But if the talent is this centralized, how do these companies actually move when they hit the next layer of complexity, the logistics of taking a localized hit and making it a global standard? We're looking at a tug of war today between two very different philosophies of growth. On one side, you have the expansion at all costs model, burning through billions to plant flags everywhere at once. On the other, you have the surgical, hyper-localized approach that waits for the perfect moment to strike. So, Alex, if you're building the next unicorn, which side are you betting on for the global expansion playbook?
If you want to survive the next decade, you bet on the surgical approach, but with a massive caveat. The perfect moment is arriving much earlier than it used to. The traditional startup lifecycle, where you hit hundreds of millions in revenue before even thinking about a second country, is being rendered obsolete. We're seeing a shift where API-driven technology and AI-driven localization allow products to be discovered and adapted for new markets almost instantly.
The wait-and-see strategy is dead because the C part is now automated. That sounds like a recipe for a very expensive, very globalized mess.
It's a mess if you lack the unit economics to handle it. Look at Bolt. During the COVID lockdowns, they faced an 85% drop in ride-hailing revenue. But because they had the structural agility to pivot, they scaled food and grocery delivery to 16 countries in just 4 months. They didn't need to try to conquer the world simultaneously. They used a sequential expansion strategy, mastering one playbook before moving to the next to avoid that capital depletion you're worried about.
I love that you call it mastering a playbook instead of ignoring the fact that you're running out of cash. But even with a good playbook, setting up shop isn't exactly a low-cost endeavor. I've heard the price tag for a new country entity can be eye-watering.
It really is. We're talking about a $5 million to $10 million burden in legal and localization expenses just to secure that first major deal. Because that cost is so high, the smartest startups are moving away from full-scale local operations and toward what A16Z calls a top-heavy strategy. Instead of building an entire ecosystem, you target the 5 to 10 most influential companies in a region like Japan or Korea, where a single successful contract can provide massive, scalable revenue.
Instead of building a house in every country, you're just trying to buy the keys to the most important mansions. It's a bit power broker, isn't it?
The A16Z show noted that venture firms are shifting from being purely investment-focused to an active power broker model. They use their influence to bridge the gap between portfolio companies and government leaders in places like Saudi Arabia or Mexico. We saw this with Flow. They achieved extreme agility by transitioning from a foreign entity to a localized Saudi operating company in just 60 days through strategic local leadership and flexible software architecture.
Okay, but even if you play the political game, you still have the language barrier problem. Unless you're planning on hiring 1,000 translators, which given the $10 million entry cost is probably out of the question.
That's where the tech stack becomes your moat. We're seeing AI-driven localization fundamentally change the cost structure of expansion. For example, 11 Labs is using AI dubbing to allow content providers like Televisa Univision to expand into markets like France and Poland without the massive overhead of traditional dubbing houses. Even Bolt is using AI to automate over 50% of their customer care interactions. This allows them to scale revenue and geographical footprint without a corresponding increase in headcount. It essentially lets a startup maintain a flat growth pattern in personnel even while their user base explodes.
The dream is a global from day one architecture where your software does the heavy lifting of being a local. But does that actually work in places where business is done via handshake and a long lunch?
You can't ignore the human element. Raghu Raghuram pointed out that while software enables early entry, regions like North Asia still require a localized, relationship-based presence. You can automate the translation, but you can't automate the trust. The real winners are the companies that use AI to handle the universal parts of the product, the logistics, the UI, the support, so they can focus their actual human capital on those high-level regional relationships.
It sounds like the goal is to be a digital ghost, everywhere at once but with very little physical weight.
And that weightlessness is a structural defense. As the A16Z show argued, the extreme frugality required by these smaller-scale, highly efficient constraints creates a foundation of superior unit economics that large, high-burn competitors simply cannot replicate or culturally pivot back to once they've grown bloated.
Founders need to stop viewing international markets as distant frontiers and start seeing them as API calls away.
Watch for the first major top-heavy win in a market like Saudi Arabia, where a U.S. startup captures a state-linked enterprise without ever opening a physical office. That will prove the power broker model is the new standard.
But if we can automate the software of the world, what happens when we start trying to automate the actual physical world? If your tractor can suddenly think its way through a field, does that mean the next great tech unicorn isn't a social media app but a high-tech harvester?
That's exactly what we're seeing in this new industrial revolution, Maya, where AI is moving out of the cloud and into physical infrastructure, essentially turning legacy industries like agriculture and retail into highly sophisticated, data-driven ecosystems.
The future of tech is just more expensive ways to avoid doing yard work, automating the harvest, replacing the warehouse picker, and eventually teaching your toaster to renegotiate your mortgage.
Not quite, but the shift is massive. Take John Deere. As discussed on Masters of Scale, they aren't just selling tractors anymore. They are controlling the entire agricultural tech stack by integrating hardware, software, and cloud processing into a closed-loop ecosystem. We're seeing machines like the $2 million 9RX830 tractor move toward edge computing, where the machine processes massive amounts of sensor data from LiDAR and radar locally to make real-time decisions without waiting for a cloud response.
A $2 million tractor that makes its own decisions. It's one step away from the machine deciding it's tired of corn and wants to pursue a career in poetry.
It's actually solving much more practical manual problems. The goal isn't to replace the farmer, but to bridge the dexterity gap using humanoid robots for high-value crops like berries or mangoes that require delicate handling, and automating dull, dirty, and dangerous tasks like cleaning grain bins. Even the interface is changing. Generative AI is replacing those clunky static dashboards with natural language, so a farmer can just ask a prompt about soil health.
So instead of reading a spreadsheet, you just text your tractor, "Hey, how's the nitrogen looking?"
Worth noting, this isn't limited to the field. Richard Dixon of Gap recently noted that AI is transitioning from a back-end logistics tool to a foundational operating platform that will drive direct, consumer-facing personalization in retail. He argues that corporations face a binary future. They either master this AI integration or face eventual obsolescence as it becomes the primary platform for all business operations.
It sounds like the barrier to entry is collapsing, though. If everyone has the platform, where is the moat?
The moat is shifting from data volume to architectural efficiency. The A16Z show argued that the data flywheel theory in autonomous driving is empirically false, meaning superior technical architecture and sensor integration can achieve commercial-grade results with significantly less data than we previously assumed. We are seeing a massive structural shift in the economics of these systems because the cost of entry has dropped orders of magnitude. As of 2026, training costs per flop are down 150 times and sensor costs are down 100 times since the Waymo era.
The advantage isn't who has the most data, but who can build the smartest, cheapest sensor array to process it on the fly.
There's a signal here. It's about the move from centralized intelligence to distributed edge-based autonomy.
Seed stage investors should stop looking for the next SaaS dashboard and start looking for the companies building the hardware-software nervous systems for heavy machinery. Watch for the first major deployment of humanoid robots in large-scale berry harvests, because if they can solve the dexterity problem, the unit economics of the entire fruit industry will fundamentally rewrite itself. Looking back at everything we've covered today, the through line is unmistakable. We are witnessing the dissolution of the interface. Whether it's the headless logic of Salesforce, the massive surge in Slack bot activity, or the edge computing powering a John Deere tractor, the value is migrating away from what we can see and click toward the invisible autonomous structures running in the background.
Something to flag here for the founders and VCs listening. The single most important implication is that the core unit of competitive advantage is shifting from technical execution to architectural orchestration. If you are a seed stage founder, your primary challenge is no longer just building a functional product, but ensuring your system can survive the scrutiny of an automated auditor and integrate into a global agentic workflow. Your success depends on how well your software can talk to the autonomous agents of your customers, moving your focus from UI design to the integrity of your underlying data and regulatory compliance.
It's a move from being a builder of tools to a designer of ecosystems. The margin for error in your business logic is shrinking as the vibe coding era meets the hard reality of GDPR and IRS benchmarks.
Right. The stakes are much higher when your users aren't humans, but other autonomous programs. We're looking for the companies that can navigate this complexity without the massive overhead of traditional expansion.
Keep your eyes on the upcoming expansion announcements from the likes of 11 Labs or Luma. Specifically, watch for a high-value contract win from a US-based startup in a market like Saudi Arabia or Japan that relies entirely on AI-driven localization without a single local office. That will be the definitive proof that this top-heavy global model isn't just a theory, but a repeatable blueprint for the new era of scale.
That's the signal to watch. Thanks for joining us this Monday. We'll see you next week.